Good morning. This is Judge Gary Katzmann.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Everyone's here, and we're recording, so with your permission, I'll call the case and get everyone on the record.
Excellent.
United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Katzmann presiding before Court Number 18-00208, Faba Wood Cabinetry Corporation et al. Versus the United States et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiffs?
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Matt Nicely with Hughes, Hubbard & Reed on behalf of Faba Wood.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Kristen Smith with Sandler, Travis, and Rosenberg with Sarah Yuskaitis, representing IKEA Supply AG.
This is Sonia Orfield with the Department of Justice, representing the government, and also with me on the phone is Rachel Bogdan of the Department of Commerce.
Good morning, Your Honor. Hi, good morning, Your Honor. This is Tim Brightbill from Wiley Ryan on behalf of Defendant Intervenor Coalition for Fair Trade and Hardwood Plywood. Also on the phone with me is my colleague, Stephanie Bell.
Good morning, counsel. I hope that you are all safe and well. We are here this morning, of course, oral argument in the matter of Faba Wood Cabinetry Corporation et al. Versus United States. The parties have filed substantial briefs. They have also responded to detailed questions that the court submitted, and I received the answers on Monday. Very helpful. And this morning's session, as you know, is an opportunity for you to engage each other. The responses that were submitted on Monday provide an opportunity for you to essentially make rebuttal to those answers. I will give the parties the opportunity to make an opening statement if you wish, but you each have 50 minutes aside, and I understand the allocations have been communicated to Mr. Goal. As I understand it, the plaintiff will speak for 25 minutes, plaintiff intervener for 25, the government for 30 minutes, and the defendant intervener 20 minutes. Rest assured that the court has an open mind and is very eager to hear your presentations. The pandemic, of course, is not stopping our work. We are moving forward. In terms of the teleconference communications, you've probably already been informed by Mr. Gold that it's helpful to mute your phones when you are not speaking. I would also suggest that perhaps one does not accelerate the normal speed of argument so that the recordings are properly made. And the recording will also be placed on the court's website at the conclusion of the hearing. This is a case, of course, arising from the final scope determination of the Department of Commerce issued September 7, 2018, concerning the anti-dumping and countervailing duty orders on hardwood plywood from the People's Republic of China. We will, without further ado, we will begin with the plaintiff. Mr. Nicely.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Good morning. I have a very short opening just to sort of round out or provide a quick summary of our case that I'll start with, and then I'll jump into responding to the answers that you were provided by the government and by the defendant interveners.
Thank you. By the way, Mr. Nicely, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. One other point of clarification that I'd like to make to make sure that we're all on the same page on how you want to handle this is you issued through Mr. Goal a short list of additional questions that you wanted us to address. I guess we'll get to those at the end or whenever you'd like us to address them, but we're prepared to address those as well.
Sure. You can address those whichever way fits in best with your presentation.
Okay.
And if it's easiest for you to present your responses at the end, please do.
Okay. Very good. Well, let me start again. And I don't know, Mr. Goal, if we need to announce ourselves every time we speak. I think it's probably pretty obvious who's speaking, but I guess I'll try to do that each time that we're interrupted to make sure. In any event, this again is Matt Nicely for Fabuid. I'm just going to start with a quick overview. In our view, and on behalf of ourselves as well as the defendant, the plaintiff, interveners, we think this is a pretty straightforward case. The first issue is that the whole case started incorrectly. Petitioner Masterbrand never gave Commerce a specific product to consider. Rather, it is essentially rewrote the RTA exclusion in the scope in a way that it wished it had written it originally. They could have gone to IKEA or some other place to come up with a specific example of a cabinet that arrives in multiple boxes, but it didn't bother to do so. They didn't bother to do so, and the reason they didn't do so is because they wanted, in effect, an advisory opinion from the Commerce Department. And the Commerce Department, in turn, impermissibly allowed them to get away with that. The next issue is that Commerce decided this case based solely on the scope as written, which sometimes the Commerce Department itself refers to as a K-0 approach, despite admitting to ambiguity in the scope when it said that the scope, quote, does not expressly address the manner in which RTA kitchen cabinets must be packaged to be suitable for purchase, nor expressly define the term end user, which is on page 17 of their final ruling. Commerce also fails to adequately address the fact that when the scope intended to say single package, it did so, but it did not do so with regard to RTA kitchen cabinets. So faced with such a lack of clarity, where clearly more than one interpretation was possible, the Commerce Department needed to have relied on the factors set forth in Regulation 351.225(k)(1) and, if necessary, K2, but Commerce chose not to. And if it had, it would have realized from the ITC's investigation, among other things, that the definition of end user in this industry is far broader than solely a retail consumer. It includes companies like builders who, incidentally, would, in fact, oftentimes need to rely upon written instructions. I've seen it done in my own home, for instance. Finally, Commerce and Petitioner Masterbrand have always claimed that this case does not cover furniture and furniture parts. But this is exactly what they've covered with this scope ruling. As IKEA and CNC have argued, the fact that furniture and furniture parts were not part of the original investigation at the ITC is fatal to Commerce's position here, as this scope ruling serves to expand the scope to products for which the ITC never issued an injury finding. With that, Your Honor, I'd like to now just go and deal with some of the answers that the government provided. Just so we're looking at the same document, I'm looking at page 4 of their document, because up until that point we largely agree with their conclusions. And as you've pointed out in your follow-up questions, some of their first answers are actually different as between the government and the petitioner Masterbrand. But I'll let them deal with that in their answers to you. The government claims that Commerce reasonably determined that Petitioner Masterbrand's amended scope ruling request contained the required technical characteristics and HTS classifications to the extent reasonably available. As I mentioned in my opening, what they provided to the Commerce Department, even in their amended scope ruling, wasn't a product. It was a hypothetical situation that covered a vast array of, potentially vast array of products. It was essentially a redrafting, as I mentioned, of the RTA exclusion, written in a way that Petitioner and Masterbrand apparently wished that they had written it originally. And if they'd gone and looked for themselves on the market and come up with examples, that was the whole point of the scope ruling request process, to come up with a specific product, they would have been able to show, if they had a problem with it, that there are examples of cabinets out there in the marketplace that are, that do come in more than one box because of varying dimensions, freight considerations, air in the box, et cetera, et cetera. So the notion that they couldn't and didn't have information reasonably available to them to come up with a more specific product is just, in our view, nonsense. You ask in a question that begins on their response to you on page 5, in your part C of your question 1, this is this issue about whether the agency's decisional path is reasonably discernible. In our view, this is a complete red herring. This is not an issue about a decisional path that is or is not reasonably discernible, because what happened here is a question of whether or not it was reasonable to accept the amended application. It was pretty clear. We can all agree what the decisional path was of the Commerce Department here. They effectively rejected the first request, but then accepted the second request. That doesn't mean the second request passed muster under the department's own regulations and its practice. And speaking of practice, I'm now turning to their footnote off of Part D of your first question, where they complain about our reference to the bedroom furniture case and a rejected request there. By the way, we cited that as precedent for the department's own practice, where it has been known. So it doesn't matter that it's not on the record. This is reciting to a Commerce Department decision to demonstrate to you their practice of rejecting a deficient request in the past. And in that case, the importer asked about a specific product, much more specific than what they received from the petitioner Masterbrand in this case. Yet the department ended up rejecting it because it didn't suit them, didn't fit the standard to a T. The fact that they haven't done so, I guess merely because of the ones requesting it this time were the petitioners, shouldn't have mattered. Moving on to question 3. Yes.
Mr. Nicely, I'm hearing you perfectly, and I'm following along. I just want to let you know that.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Your Honor. So the notion, part of their answer to question 3A is that instructions are only needed by, I guess, by consumers like you and me. Why this would be, I'm not sure. A manufacturer that has put together, put into a box or multiple boxes, a cabinet with lots of parts. It seems to me that because of the way the manufacturer put it together, anyone, whether you and me as a consumer or a builder, for instance, would potentially need those instructions. So that the notion that meant The fact that, the instructions have to be in the box means that we're talking about a retail consumer, we think is just simply not credible. We also point out that they talk about how that if it's going to a retail customer, by definition, it's only going to be in a package. Again, I've already mentioned that, and IKEA and Ms. Smith can go into this in more detail on behalf of her client, for whom this is common practice. It is not certain that simply because it's going to a consumer that it would need to be in a single box, and that is not what the text of the scope says, the RTA exclusion says. And if it had meant that, as we have said, with regard to vanities, that language is used. It wasn't used with regard to kitchen cabinets. Their answer to you with regard to 3B continues to talk about how this was unambiguous. I've already talked about this. Fact is that they admitted themselves that it was far less clear, and they admitted within their own decision that they had to explain what the terms meant. And there, as we've told you in our answers to questions and in our briefs, Your Honor, there are plenty of cases that support the notion that when the Commerce Department does what it did here, it is, in fact, not merely deciding what the text means, but it's, in fact, expanding on what the text says, which multiple courts, multiple decisions by, including by the Court of Appeals, have said is improper. What it should have done in light of that was to look to the K1 and K2 factors that we urged the Commerce Department to consider during the proceeding, and they just simply chose not to do so. With regard to some of the additional questions that you asked, I'm wondering whether now may be a time to address some of those.
Whatever works best for you, Mr. Knightley.
Okay. I think this now may be as good a time as any, given that I think I've got enough time to leave Ms. Smith the time that she needs to address some of the other questions. I think it may be helpful to talk about this issue about a scope inquiry versus circumvention. You ask in your first question for all the parties, you ask, is there a case that says that a scope inquiry is impermissible where an anti-circumvention inquiry might also apply? And I guess I want to make clear before I even mention the case that I think is relevant or cases that I think are relevant, I want to mention something that's critical to understand. Scope versus anti-circumvention inquiries are decidedly different concepts. Scope inquiries concern whether a product is already within the scope. Anti-circumvention inquiries concern whether a product that is outside the scope should be brought within it. There are specific provisions under 19 U.S.C. 1677J on this. They're also reflected in 19 CFR 351-225G through J. The CAFC's decision in ArcelorMittal Stainless Belgium is the clearest case on this point, and we've given you the quotation from that case before. It's in our answers to questions. I think it may also be in IKEA's. What the Court of Appeals said there was that the Court of International Trade did not give full weight to the manifest injustice of enlarging the scope of the proceeding in this offhand manner. To do what Commerce has done here is to invite arbitrariness and uncertainty into the process by which Commerce administers its anti-dumping duty orders. Commerce is not at liberty to ignore the plain terms of an order in what appears to be, in retrospect, an effort to better reflect the intent of the petitioners. If Commerce is concerned about circumvention, it should conduct a circumvention inquiry under 19 U.S.C. 1677J. And this is the key. What it cannot do is interpret the order in a manner that changes the scope, as it did here. In laminated woven sacks, stands for the same proposition. And in that case, the court was, that's a court of internet, a CIT decision citing Mitsubishi Electric. So I wanted to make sure we got that point across, that this is very, these two concepts are quite different. And while the government and the petitioners may say that this is not an issue of circumvention, they're the ones, the petitioners and the master brand are the ones who use terminology that gave the impression and used, in fact, terminology like circumvention and evasion. Well, if they thought that something was being untoward was being done, by the way, with regard to evasion, then they should have used the CBP process, the EPA process, to deal with that. The fact is that they're concerned about minor processing, but if that was their concern, that the scope didn't sufficiently capture the minor processing that they think goes on to put a cabinet into two boxes instead of one, then they should have brought a circumvention case. So with that, I think we can come back to some of your other questions later, but let me turn it over to Ms. Smith so she can turn to the rest of the government's responses and the independent intervener's responses.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Nicely. Ms. Smith?
Sure. Thank you very much. This is Kristen Smith, and as I mentioned, we represent IKEA Supply AG. And so I'm going to start by addressing question number 4, and that's on page 10 of the questions that were forwarded to us. So this question asked the government and intervener to look at the question regarding whether RTA kitchen cabinets being shipped commercially, whether it's practicable for them to be packaged in one box or more than one box. And the department responded by saying that really the record evidence on the record supported having a one-box single package requirement. Now, one thing that's important to note that the statements that they use for support from this come directly from scope requests that were outlining petitioner master brand circumvention concerns. So really the record evidence addressing this issue was talking about concerns that petitioner has that non-subject merchandise might be included within this non-subject RTA cabinets when shipped to the United States. Now, in looking at the government's response, one thing that we do want to note, it looks like the government referenced a number of sites to the petition. We think those were actually to the scope request, the amended scope request. One of the examples is amended scope ruling request at page 10. And so we just wanted to point that out. If we're incorrect, the government can comment on that. If it truly is a reference to the petition, I'd like to point out that does support what we've been saying to the court, that we do think it's important to look at the K-1 criteria and looking in the case. Now, one thing on this issue that we think is really important to point out, that Commerce's order must be enforced based on what the actual order says, not what Commerce wished that the order had said. And so here, it's important to note, and as Mr. Nicely had explained when he was speaking, that the order has no limit of the number of boxes that can be used. And for the preposition of, Commerce must look at what the order says, not what they want to say, we would point the court to look at the case Bell Supply Company that specifically addresses this issue. Now, for IKEA, just for the court's understanding, the RTA exclusion did not have a limit to boxes, and this is very important for IKEA based on how they do their business. You know, IKEA's RTA kitchen cabinets at times may be packaged in more than one box, but at the time of import, they always meet the requirements set out in the RTA exclusion, meaning that they have all the wooden cabinet pieces, they have instructions, and they have all the necessary hardware to put the cabinets together. The reason why there may be more than one box is really for commercial purposes. You know, IKEA is a big box store. Customers that go in need to be able to pick up the package, also their employees, to put it in a cart, to fit it in a car. A lot of the packages are also sold online, and that means that they're shipped through commercial services like Federal Express and UPS. And the size and weight of the package has a big impact on shipping costs. And for IKEA, that's something that's very important to them, trying to keep the cost to their customers as reasonable as possible. Now, one of the questions or issues that came up is B, and that asks, how does the single packaging requirement protect domestic producers? And here, too, in looking at this question and their response. The government that talks a lot about issues such as customs being able to enforce the exclusion. But there's one thing that's really important to understand. Protection of the domestic industry is not a standard for scope inquiries. It's not something that's considered. You know, what's important is the actual scope language of the order itself. And if you look at 19 CFR 351 225, you know how the impact of the domestic industry is not a requirement or something that is considered as part of a scope review request. Now, in this case, there was a lot of post hoc revision of the scope to administer whether it's to help the order to be administered according to the government. Now, that's something that happens during the investigation stage of the case. So in the investigation, the Commerce Department does look very closely at the scope language to ensure that customs can administer it and it's not clear. And that's precisely the reason why there's a period for companies to comment to Commerce regarding scope issues, and that's what happened actually in this case. IKEA takes their role as an importer very seriously, and so when new investigations are filed, they look very closely at the scope to make sure that their goods are not covered by the scope of the order, and where they feel it's necessary, they actually reach out to Commerce. They did so here, seeking confirmation that their products, such as the RTA cabinets that are under review, fall outside the scope of the investigation. Now, if there was truly an issue in this case as far as administrability, there's issues here. Another way to go about this, if there are problems with bad importers that are circumventing the order, as Mr. Nicely explained, petitioners could have filed an IEPA investigation request with Customs, and they could have looked at that. But Commerce can't now, after the order's in place, insert new language or requirements that didn't exist. And this is something that the court has confirmed in Cheyang Yuanda Aluminum. In this case, the court was looking at an exclusion, and what they said was the exclusion must encompass merchandise which is or may be imported into the United States in order to act as a meaningful exclusion, and anything less renders the exclusion howl and properly changes the meaning of that exclusion. So that's what's going on here, essentially. Commerce, by limiting the exclusion, is really changing or taking away part of the exclusion, rendering it effectively hollow. So the next question that I'm going to address is number five. And the question here was, in our case briefs, we discussed that Commerce had changed the verb packaged to now read as...
This is question five of the government's response?
Yes, so it's question number five, and it's on page...
14.
14, correct.
Thank you. Just wanted to make sure we're on the same page.
Sure.
Thank you.
So here, whether in our case briefs, we discussed that Commerce changed the verb packaged to read as noun, the package. In their response, the government discusses the fact that actually, in their view, the word package is an adverb. We disagree with the government on two fronts with their response to the question. First is we disagree that it's an adverb. In our view, the word was used as a verb in the scope language. They cited some references to dictionaries. We note that the Merriam-Webster dictionary also defines package as a verb. But really what we think is more important to the issue and what the court should focus on is the plain reading of the scope language. And what that does is when you look at the scope language, Commerce's scope determination added additional requirements to the RTA exclusion. And by doing that, it unlawfully expanded the scope of the orders. And the law on this issue is clear. You know, Commerce, they can, in a scope proceeding, interpret the scope of the order, but they may not expand it. And so in this case, RTA cabinets are defined as kitchen cabinets, defined a package for sale or ultimate purchase by an end user that at the time of importation includes, and then the scope sets forth the three requirements. Now, the exclusion itself in the scope language has no limits on the number of boxes. It really just specifies what must be included at the time of import. And this is very different than other parts of the scope that do address the number of boxes. And so there's two examples. One is vanities and one is linen closets. And in both of these exclusions, the scope language very clearly specifies that all of the parts, with the exception of feet, must be packaged within one box. And so we think these are really important issues for the court to take into account. Now, in Section A, the court looks at the language from Ericsson G Mobile Communications and addressing the issue of Commerce's substantial freedom to interpret and clarifying the anti-dumping order and asking, you know, was the change that Commerce made beyond their authority to interpret the scope based on that case. And so Commerce said that no, in response, that they felt that they had not made any changes to the anti-dumping scope, and they referred the court to the findings in the Walgreen case. And as I'm going to describe, we think that we disagree with Commerce's decision. First of all, we believe just the plain language of the scope doesn't necessitate that products that need to be shipped in one package. You know, there's no limits if you look at the language. We also feel that this case and the way that the government is citing it is very separate and distinct. In the Walgreens case, what the government was looking at was whether subject tissue paper, so the product at issue, no one disputed that it was not subject to orders. Subject tissue paper packages and gift packs with non-subject merchandise. And so what the court was looking at was whether the fact that it was packaged with non-subject merchandise took it outside the scope. Now, the issue before the court here is whether non-subject merchandise, you know, it's been specifically excluded from an order, can now be placed under the scope of the order under the guise of the scope determination. And the answer for that is no, it may not. Now, the next question is question number six. And so that is on page 17 of the questions that we've received from the court. Here, the issue that the court is looking at is whether the terms of the order, if they're not dispositive and should have been analyzed under K1 and K2 factors, whether the court would need to remand this back with instructions for Commerce to look at that. Here, actually, we do agree with Commerce. We agree that if the court determines that the language of the orders is not dispositive with respect to the hardwood plywood shipped without materials that are not packaged in a suitable manner for purchase by an end user, that you would need to send this back to Commerce with instructions to analyze the request under 35-225-K1 and K2 also, if necessary. The next question is question 7, and this question involves during the course of the inquiry, Commerce rejected some rebuttal comments that IKEA filed on the basis that the department felt that the comments were not rebuttal comments and that because of that, they were untimely filed. We, in looking at this issue, we would like to withdraw this issue from the court's consideration. We think that the more important issues in the case are really that Commerce expanded the scope of the case, unlawfully expanded the order. We would thank the court's attention to the issue, but we'd like to withdraw the issue from the court's consideration. Now, the last question that I'll address from the initial questions with respect to the government is the question about what cases and authorities best support their arguments. And they referred to several cases. One is the Walgreens case. And so they talk about the language of the order is the cornerstone in any scope determination. We think that for this proposition, the Walgreens case supports IKEA's position that Commerce failed to follow the language of the RTA cabinet exclusion, and they instead expanded the scope of the orders by adding two requirements which are not included in the exclusionary language of the orders. So Commerce pointed out that the RTA cabinet exclusion does not expressly address the manner in which the RTA cabinets must be packaged to be suitable for purchase, nor expressly defines the end user. And this is the final scope at 17. Commerce acknowledged that the plain language reading of the scope does not address the manage of packaging or the definition of end user, but despite the acknowledgement that the language of the order does not address the meaning of packaging or end using, they proceeded to determine in their decision that the scope language is unambiguous. And there's no rational connection between a plain reading of the view of the scope language as acknowledged by the defendant and the conclusions drawn. And so we think that Commerce misapplies the primary criteria for determining scope inconsistent with Walgreens. And as mentioned earlier, this case involved gift-back sets subject to a scope ruling request involving subject merchandise, and it did not fall under any of the exclusions subject to the order. The scope in this case specifically included tissue paper packaged in film boxes and bags for distribution and use by the ultimate user, consumer. And the question presented to the court was whether the gift bag sets were subject merchandise. And in affirming Commerce's decision based on the final order, the K1 criteria were deemed dispositive. And issuing this determination, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit confirmed that it's the language of the Department of Commerce's final order that defines the scope of the order, albeit with the aid of anti-dumping petition, the factual findings, and legal conclusions adduced from the administrative investigations and the preliminary order. And while the petition, factual findings, legal conclusions, and preliminary orders can aid in the analysis, they can't substitute for the language of the order themselves, which remains the cornerstone in the scope decision. So we actually think this case is helpful to support legal arguments made by IKEA and by petitioner in this case. The court refers to SunTech Industries with respect to commands that the court hears a challenge to an agency action, due action shall be taken of the rule of prejudicial error. This case was cited with respect to rejecting the rebuttal arguments. As mentioned, we withdraw that issue, and thank you for your consideration of that. The Newkirk case, this addresses when an agency has not made a particular determination explicitly, and the agency's ruling nonetheless may be sustained as long as the path of the agency may be reasonably discerned. Here, defendant argues that by accepting the amended scope ruling request, Commerce indicated the degree of particularity missing from the internal scope ruling request, and that it was cured by the amended request filed by Master Brands. And although not discussed in the final scope ruling, defendant would ask this court to find a connection between the initial and amended scope acceptance as being a path reasonably discerned. We think that this ignores the issue at hand. The issue is not whether one can reasonably assume that Commerce deemed the initial scope deficiencies cured absent the discussion in the final scope ruling, as the defendant would like the court to believe. But really, the issue here is whether the scope ruling request and subsequent final scope ruling focuses on a particular product consistent in 19 CFR 351, 225A, and C1. And this is really a threshold question that IKEA, and also as Mr. Nicely talked about, submits has not been met here. Petitioner also references Senate Report 103-412, and this, it was referenced for the discussing the Congress's intent for Commerce to make circumvention determinations on a case-by-case basis in recognition of the facts in each individual case in light of the nature of specific industries. And as IKEA addressed in its case briefs, a scope ruling clarifies the coverage of the order for all imports. This is different from a circumvention case, which is based upon company-specific information regarding evasive imports. Now, the legislative history clearly establishes Congress's intent for Commerce to make circumvention decisions on a case-by-case basis in recognition of the fact that each individual case, there's in the light of the different natures of different specific industries. Now, the court has looked at this issue in the past, and what they've explained is that where Commerce is concerned about circumvention, and clearly that's something that has been brought up by Commerce and Master Brands in this case, the appropriate method to resolve such a concern would be to appear in proceedings under the provisions that are specifically designed to prevent circumvention. And in this matter, Commerce interpreted the scope improperly by expanding the scope of the orders to address circumvention concerns in the context of a scoping inquiry. So this is not conducted on a case-by-case basis as it's done in anti-circumvention, and it's not in accordance with the statute. Also, it's not following the requirements for an anti-circumvention case, which has very limited specific instances that Commerce can include product that may be facially excluded from an order on its face under the scope of the order, and that would include things like merchandise being assembled in the U.S. or a third country, newly developed merchandise, or merchandise that has been minorly changed. And then the last case that they cite is UK Carbon and Graphite, and we believe that this case is also not relevant to the case at hand. Here, it considered Commerce's decision to include unfinished small-diameter graphite electrodes shipped to China to the UK for minor completion or assembly, whether that circumvented the order. And so Commerce's decision to treat a product here that fell outside the scope of the order, subject merchandise, was affirmed in that case because the anti-circumvention requirements, not scope, were met for an affirmative finding. In this case, Commerce conducted a scope inquiry, but they unlawfully expanded the scope of the orders to include merchandise falling outside the scope of the literal scope of the orders. And the last question that I'll discuss is number nine.
Yes.
At least with respect to the government. And that's on page... and it asked the government, as far as any recent or pending Federal Circuit cases that may affect the court's analysis. We think that actually a more appropriate case that this could, as far as recent cases that the court should look at, is TNB 4AAE Inc. versus the United States. This is a recently decided case before the Court of International Trade. This case addressed the issue of whether pipe that's threaded to meet a particular aerospace threading standard after import should be excluded from an anti-dumping and countervailing duty order on seamless standard carbon and alloy steel pipe because the pipe met the scope's aerospace exclusion. Here, Commerce determined that the orders were unambiguous. They found the pipe subject to the order, and the court remanded on the basis that Commerce was required to consult K1 sources in considering whether the pipe was properly included within the scope. Now, with respect to the questions that the court issued for, with respect to the new questions, we agree with Mr. Nicely in his comments. We do not think that we believe that with requests for number one, scope inquiries and anti-circumvention inquiries are very separate and distinct proceedings. They look at very different things, and we agree with the case law cited by Mr. Nicely, so ArcelorMittal Stainless Belgium. I think the court hears very clear if Commerce is concerned about circumvention, it needs to conduct a circumvention inquiry. You know, what it can't do is it cannot interpret an order in a manner that changes the scope of the order, and that's what's happened here. With respect to furniture parts, and this was also a question that was brought up with respect to master brands, we think that this question, first of all, is best suited for the court to look at as part of the final scope ruling. Commerce found that the order is unambiguous concerning plywood that's undergone minor processing, and they concluded that any combination of processing, it remains subject for merchandise. But the issue is that at the same time, they found furniture and furniture parts that undergo the same type of processing are not intended to be included under the scope of the order, and these findings are really inconsistent. We ask that the court remand the matter for further clarification, because in our view, it's not supported by substantial evidence, and for this reason, it's just not in accordance to law. And so we thank the court for this opportunity to address the questions that you presented, and happy to answer questions.
I was wondering, could you give me the case site for the recent CIT decision, which I'm familiar with? If it would be helpful to have the actual case number.
Yeah, if you give me 1 minute, I can get that for you.
Kristen, I can give that to him.
Okay.
Your Honor, this is Matt Nicely. I think you're referring to TMB 440AE?
Yes.
Right? Yes. Versus the United States. Are you looking for the UPSUP site?
If it's available.
Yeah, it's referenced on page 14 of Fabula's answers to your questions. And I think it's also referenced on IKEA's, the last page of IKEA's answers as well on their page 16.
I see that. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor, if I may, is there any more time in our 50 minutes? I didn't see what time we actually started.
5 minutes.
We have 5 minutes left?
Yes.
Kristen and Your Honor, if you would, I'd like to just mention one or two other things, reacting to some of the other things that that Petitioner Masterbrand raised in their answers to your questions. In our view, they're raising a straw man in a couple of places where they talk about, and I'm thinking specifically, it starts on page 11, and they carry on and raise these types of issues over on page 15 as well, where they are concerned about that if the Commerce Department had interpreted the scope in any other way, parties could import hardware plywood and claim that the merchandise was part of an RTA kitchen cabinet, the other components of which were shipped separately. Well, the interesting thing about this and the reason why it takes us back to why it's so important to have started with a specific product. Because, and what I mean when I say that they're raising a straw man here is the fact is that the scope language uses the terminology at the time of importation. Petitioner Masterbrand claims that we're seeking to read that portion of the scope and of the RTA exclusion out of the scope. That's nonsense, complete nonsense, because in fact, we think that's their protection. You could have a product come into the United States in two different boxes, but be in the same shipment, imported at the time of importation, as the language of the RTA exclusion says. That ensures the kinds of issues that they're raising with regard, I guess, to customs enforceability, et cetera. But if the fact is that it's coming in at the same time, the fact that they're in two different boxes should not matter. They already have the protection they need with that language of at the time of importation. So we think they've raised a straw man here. There's no issue to the extent that is not happening. Then, in fact, again, as we said, as both I and Ms. Smith have said, you're dealing with an issue of evasion, not an issue of a scope issue. So I just want to make sure that's clear, that language, we are not seeking to read it out of the language of the scope at all. And, in fact, we think they don't recognize the extent to which that actually offers them the protection they need. So I think that was the primary other topic. And I think, Your Honor, we have effectively addressed your questions that you posed just yesterday, although I'm not sure we addressed directly. I think we've kind of hit it, but I don't know that we've addressed directly your question number one for Fabiewood and IKEA. Doesn't your answer to invention argument rest on the court finding the scope ruling impermissibly expanded? The fact is that we think that they have impermissibly expanded. In our view, a proper analysis that includes consideration of the K1 factors and, if necessary, the K2 factors will prove that what Petitioner and Masterbrand were seeking was an expansion of the scope. That the statute, the regs, and the case law do not allow. And at that point, Petitioner Masterbrand could possibly ask Commerce to conduct a circumvention inquiry in order to determine whether the processing that is done to an RTA cabinet that is in more than one package meets the standard set forth in 19 U.S.C. 1677 J.C. So we do think... that the petitioners would have to go forward and seek to prove that, in fact, there was circumvention going on. With that, I think we've exhausted our time, and we're happy to answer any questions that the court may have.
Well, thank you very much, counsel, for your fine presentation. I think we can move on to the defendant and defendant intervener. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Sonia Orfield for the United States. Based upon the court's instructions, I will simply address the questions that the court posed by email yesterday and its earlier questions posed to plaintiff and plaintiff intervener. With respect to that earlier set of questions, I will try to combine related questions so that I don't get too repetitive. To begin with, yesterday the court asked us if there's a case that says that a scope inquiry is impermissible where an anti-circumvention inquiry might also apply. We are not aware of a case that indicates that a scope inquiry is impermissible where anti-circumvention might apply. The statute and regulations do not indicate that the scope inquiry scope inquiries and anti-circumvention inquiries are mutually exclusive. Commerce can conduct either when posed with issues of whether a product is within an order, but will examine the nature of the inquiry. For example, the parties have discussed the carbon graphite case in which petitioner requested Commerce conduct either a scope inquiry or a circumvention inquiry. In that case, Commerce acknowledged there was substantial record evidence which may support the initiation of either a scope inquiry or an anti-circumvention inquiry, but ultimately decided that anti-circumvention was more appropriate given the specificity of an allegation to a specific company and certain record information as to the timing of the pattern of trade, which is not present here. Here, MasterBrand submitted a scope ruling request and thereafter an amended scope ruling request, not a request that Commerce conducted an anti-circumvention inquiry. That was part of the basis for how Commerce proceeded in this case. The court's next question in the email series of questions is whether furniture parts with inputs of hardwood plywood are subject to the orders, whether that's a question best suited for Commerce in a scope request rather than the court. Whether a product falls within the scope of an order is an authority that's granted to Commerce to provide producers and importers with notice as to whether their products fall within the scope of anti-dumping or countervailing duty order. Congress authorized Commerce to issue scope rulings clarifying whether a particular type of merchandise is within the class or kind of merchandise described in an existing order. The Federal Circuit's also identified in Shenyang Yuanda that Commerce's expertise is often required to clarify scope language and determine whether products fall within the language of the order, which is typically written in general terms. However, to reiterate, we don't agree with the argument that the requester's scope ruling asks Commerce to redefine plywood to include wooden furniture and furniture parts. The petitioner made clear during the investigation that furniture was not covered by their proposed scope for these investigations, and the scope ruling does not expand the scope but clarifies that. To qualify for the kitchen cabinet exclusion, or the RTA kitchen cabinet exclusion, the cabinet must meet the requirements of the exclusion, and the requirements necessitate that the cabinet components be in a single package suitable for purchase by an end-use retail consumer. The requesters explained in the amended scope ruling request that they sought the scope ruling to ensure that the orders are properly enforced, and that all hardwood plywood that meets the physical description in the scope is treated as subject merchandise unless it met an express exclusion not to expand the scope to include furniture and furniture parts. Turning to the next question from yesterday's email, the court it noted that the government and petitioner Masterbrand took different positions on whether Commerce's sua sponte authority to initiate a scope inquiry could justify the scope inquiry here, should the court find the scope request deficient. To what extent did Commerce need to explain its source of authority in the and also asked to what extent the Commerce needed to explain its source of authority in the scope ruling. I think the difference noted by the court here is more of an instance of the parties reading the question differently than a disagreement. Our focus was reading the question as to question whether Commerce has the authority to initiate a scope ruling based on a defective scope ruling request. In responding no, we intended to indicate that we would not have the authority under 351.225C to initiate a scope ruling based upon a defective or deficient application. And the path in this case was that Commerce received a scope ruling request and began discussing the sufficiency and then received an amended scope ruling request. So we were operating under that path in 351.225C. But we also mentioned the alternative path in our response stating unless Commerce exercises its authority to self-initiate a scope inquiry under 19 CFR 351.225B. So we do not disagree that we have the authority to self-initiate a scope inquiry under 225B should we determine from available information that an inquiry is warranted to determine whether a product is included within the scope of an anti-dumping or countervailing duty order. In this case, we did not exercise that authority or consider the self-initiation. So it would be speculative to get into whether Commerce could have self-initiated here because Commerce has not addressed that. With respect to the extent to which Commerce needs to explain its source of authority for the scope ruling, Commerce cited 351.225B in identifying that we were initiating a scope ruling based on petitioner Masterbrand's scope ruling application and thereafter its amended application. In footnote 52 of the final scope ruling, we say in issuing this final scope ruling, we find consistent with 19 CFR 351.225C1, which provides that a scope ruling request must contain certain information to the extent reasonably available to the interested party, that the requester's amended scope ruling request provides all requisite information reasonably available to the requester and provides sufficient detail regarding the products at issue for Commerce to make a final scope ruling. So Commerce explained what path it was taking in its order. Turning to the issues raised in the prior set of questions from the court to the other parties. The courts asked the plaintiff and the government whether it needs to address either the plain language of the scope ruling or the K1 and K2 factors if the petitioner's scope ruling request was defective. And we've gotten into that with the updated question. So turning to the court's next set of questions, the court's asked Fabiwood about the interaction of the use of the term particular and the phrase reasonably available in the government's regulations. As an initial matter, the reasonably available language appears in the final sentence of the initial paragraph of 19 CFR 351.225C1. Immediately before the enumerated requirements for an application. And that clause clearly states that the application must contain the following enumerated items to the extent reasonably available to the interested party. So the regulations indicate that the request for details that follow is only required to the extent that those details are reasonably available. In balancing the meaning of particular product and reasonably available, the court should consider the specific factual scenario that occurred here. After the submission of the initial scope ruling request, Commerce requested an amended version that described the products in greater particularity, emphasizing the importance of such inclusion. And per Commerce's request, petitioner Masterbrand filed the amended scope ruling request, and Commerce indicated that the degree of particularity missing from the scope request was cured Although in its pre-argument brief, Fabiwood argues that the facts should be characterized differently, that Petitioner Masterbrand is only addressing hypothetical situations. As the Supreme Court stated in Eurodiff, the factual findings on which Commerce relies in applying its interpretation are conclusive unless unsupported by substantial evidence, which is not the case here. The courts also asked Fabiwood and IKEA if Commerce was required to conduct independent research beyond what Petitioner Masterbrand provided. No, the Secretary was not required to do this. The regulations dealing with SCIP rulings create two potential processes, which we've mentioned. The Secretary can make a determination based solely on the applications, in other words, without independent research. And then under, and that's under Section D, and under 19 CFR 351.225E, where further inquiry is warranted, the Secretary can obtain comments and factual information from interested parties, and at times when an expanded process is required, with significant issues, at times there's an expanded process when there are significant issues of difficulty involved. The courts also asked Fabiwood and IKEA about a couple of cases distinguished by Petitioner Masterbrand. First, the ArcelorMittal Stainless Belgium NV case. Fabiwood relied on that case to argue that a circumvention analysis was appropriate here because the Federal Circuit has noted that if the department's concerned about circumvention of an order, then an inquiry under Section 781 of the Tariff Act is the appropriate procedure, not a scope ruling. We agree with the Coalition and Masterbrand that ArcelorMittal is inopposite. In that case, the court found that Commerce had ignored the plain terms of the order, including merchandise that had previously been confirmed to be excluded from the order, in what appears to be, in retrospect, an effort to better reflect the intent of the parties. In contrast here, neither the requesters nor Commerce were attempting to bring previously excluded merchandise within the scope of the orders, and so the case is not applicable in this circumstance. The courts also asked Fabiwood and IKEA about laminated woven sacks committee versus United States, and Fabiwood relied on language in that case to the effect that a circumvention analysis would be appropriate there because it would better address certain types of concerns. And again, we do not think that decision advances their case. The case involved a complaint that the agency's interpretation of a relevant order increased the likelihood of circumvention. Those circumstances are simply different than the petitioner's concerns here, with obtaining clarification that certain materials were included in the scope language. The court has asked Fabiwood and IKEA to address the government's argument that Commerce is not required to conduct an anti-circumvention inquiry in every case in which Commerce is concerned about circumvention of an order. We sort of touched on that in response to new email questions. Commerce is not required to conduct an inquiry, although the statute and legislative history, I'll note, further indicate that Commerce must consider express factors when conducting an anti-circumvention inquiry. Neither the statute nor Commerce's regulations require it to conduct an anti-circumvention inquiry in any particular circumstance. And those proceedings are intended to address different concerns than those at issue here. They're intended to bring within the scope of an order merchandise that's not encompassed in the literal scope. And since the merchandise at issue is not outside of the scope of the order, that's not the situation. Instead, Masterbrand believed the scope covered such merchandise and sought confirmation from the agency. So Commerce properly undertook a scope inquiry to assess whether a particular product was included within the scope. Also, as IKEA recognized, the legislative history to Section 781 indicates Congress's intention for Commerce to make circumvention decisions on a case-by-case basis in its initial brief. The court has also asked Fabiwood how to distinguish between a ruling that defines the plain language of the orders and an exclusion that adds new language to the orders, and similarly asked IKEA about its contention that Commerce's final scope ruling was adding new language. At the outset, the court should consider the deferential substantial evidence standard afforded Commerce with respect to its ruling. Moreover, courts are particularly deferential to Commerce's interpretation of scope orders, and this really goes back to the same issue with differentiating between clarifying the scope and undertaking a circumvention inquiry. The focus of the analysis should be whether the definition is clarifying whether a product is contained within the scope of the orders or whether the product is outside the order as written, but should be included within the scope as part of the class or kind of merchandise that's subject to an anti-dumping order. That distinction is discussed in the DeSero case that I believe Petitioner Masterbrand cited in its brief. In its pre-argument filing, Fabiwood relied on case law dealing with situations where the language of Commerce's order did not support its conclusion, but those don't assist its case here because that is not the circumstance in this case. I know there is one part of the of Commerce's order that has been discussed and pointed to as notable is the section on page 17 of the order where Commerce made a statement about there not being an express definition in the order for something. And I just wanted to note that that's been sort of taken out of context and that Commerce immediately thereafter states that the exclusion, it describes the exclusion's requirements as the exclusion's unambiguous requirements and then talks about the plain language of the scope and requiring something. So I think reading that paragraph as a whole, that portion of the order doesn't support their view. The court also asked IKEA about whether Commerce is required to reach the K-1 factors, including whether it should rely on a discussion of the issue in the unpublished A.L. Patterson case, suggesting that Commerce must consider the K-1 criteria. Commerce is not required to reach the K-1 factors, and the court should not rely on that precedential case, non-precedential case, although the Federal Circuit may look to non-precedential dispositions for guidance or persuasive reasoning. They don't have the effect of binding precedent. Instead, the court should look to the precedential decisions that make clear that the language of Commerce's final order is the first inquiry. For instance, in Meridian Products, the Federal Circuit stated if the scope is not ambiguous, the plain meaning of the language governs. And similarly, in Mid-Continental Nail Corporation, the court explained that if the language is ambiguous, Commerce must next consider the regulatory history as contained in the so-called K-1 materials. And accordingly, the court should reject unpublished analysis to the contrary. I know that in oral argument this morning, the parties referred the court to TMB 44AE. I think there are certainly other cases that take a different approach, including I've lost the name of the case. There's a recent case, Perfectus Aluminum, where the court states if Commerce determines that the terms of the order are either ambiguous or reasonably subject to interpretation, then Commerce will take into account the descriptions contained in the petition, initial investigation, and prior determinations, essentially indicating that those factors are only considered after Commerce has decided that the order is ambiguous. Now, I'll also note that IKEA seems to concede in its pre-argument brief that Commerce only needs to go to the K-1 factors when the language is ambiguous on page 11 of its brief. The court has also asked Fabiwood about Petitioner Masterbrand's reliance on legislative history regarding what constitutes a sufficient petition. We would agree with the petitioner that the court may rely on legislative history to inform its interpretation, particularly if there's any ambiguity. Although 19 CFR 351.225(c)(1) is clear that the application for scope ruling requires a detailed description to the extent available, the Senate report upon which Masterbrand relied further emphasizes that point and shows that it's consistent with legislative intent, stating the committee intends the determination as to the information reasonably available to petitioner to be made in light of the circumstances of each petitioner. The courts also asked IKEA whether they're arguing that this is an evasion allegation or a circumvention allegation. This is neither. It's not an evasion allegation that belongs in front of Customs and Border Protection because Petitioner Masterbrand did not submit an evasion allegation to Customs or otherwise request such a proceeding. Rather, it made a submission to Commerce. Because Petitioner Masterbrand never requested such a proceeding and one has not been undertaken, the legitimacy of Commerce's scope ruling is unaffected by whether Commerce lacked authority to initiate an evasion proceeding or CBP could have separately undertaken such an investigation. The court may only review the underlying proceeding that Commerce chose to conduct. So the issue here is just whether Commerce's scope ruling was supported by substantial evidence and in accordance with law with respect to circumvention. Although the scope ruling requests have some discussion touching on circumvention, Commerce properly treated the request as request to clarify the scope. As we discussed in our papers, Commerce is not required to conduct an inquiry under 1677J simply because elements of circumvention are present. The legislative history, for instance, establishes Congress's intent for Commerce to make circumvention determinations on a case-by-case basis. Commerce's past treatment of instances in which record evidence may support the initiation of either a scope inquiry or anti-circumvention inquiry show this type of case-by-case analysis that we talk about in carbon and graphite, UK carbon and graphite, where Commerce looks at things like whether the allegation is very specific to a single company or there's record information as to the timing or of the pattern of trade, which are not present here. The court had asked IKEA to address Commerce's rejection of certain of its comments. We understand from based upon this morning's argument that IKEA has now withdrawn this issue, and so I won't address it further. So for all of these reasons, and for those set forth in the government's papers, we respectfully request that this court sustain Commerce's final scope ruling as supported by substantial evidence and in accordance with law. If the court has no further questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you very much, Ms. Orfield, for your fine presentation. I think we'll move to Mr. Brightbill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Tim Brightbill from Wiley Ryan. First, I hope you and your colleagues at the court and your families are all healthy and doing well.
Thank you. And you as well.
Thanks very much. I'll start with just a brief summary and then some comments on plaintiffs' answers to questions and then answers to the court's questions from yesterday. I think we align very closely with the government, so perhaps we can save some time. We do agree that the question before the court today is a straightforward one, and that is whether Commerce's scope determination was supported by substantial evidence and otherwise in accordance with law. And the evidence on the record, the briefs, and now the answers to your questions all confirm that Commerce properly found that the scope language unambiguously includes the inquiry merchandise. Commerce's decision to accept the scope ruling request and clarify the scope of the orders was supported by substantial evidence. Our clients, the Coalition for Fair Trade in Hardwood Plywood and Master Brad Campus, provided all information that was reasonably available to them. We provided detailed descriptions of the merchandise involved, and we provided evidence that this merchandise was being improperly imported into the United States. This was not a hypothetical case or an advisory opinion, nor was it a redrafting of the scope. Commerce properly found that the plain language of the scope was unambiguous. It used simple logic to find that the RTA kitchen cabinet exclusion language necessitated single packaging for purchase by an ultimate retail consumer or end user. This was also supported by substantial evidence. And we're allowed to define a scope exclusion narrowly, and that is precisely what we did. Third, Commerce properly made these determinations based on the plain language of the scope of the orders, so there was no need to proceed to K1 or K2 factors. This decision was also reasonable and supported by substantial evidence. And fourth, Commerce properly confirmed that hardwood plywood that underwent minor processing was within the scope of the orders. Importantly, this was properly a scope inquiry, not a circumvention inquiry. Whether we could have filed a circumvention request is not relevant, as this court has recognized that it's limited to reviewing the proceeding that Commerce chose to conduct. Citing for that the UK carbon and graphite case by the court in 2013. Nonetheless, as the Federal Circuit has held, and as respondents agree, a scope determination is merely a clarification of the terms of the original anti-dumping order, and that's precisely what happened here. The reason we asked for this inquiry in the first place is because we obtained information that importing companies were misinterpreting the clear language of the scope, which we put a great deal of effort into crafting with Commerce, with all of our companies, and with some respondents as well. So when we saw, immediately after we won these AD/CVD cases in 2018, that the scope language was being misinterpreted or creatively interpreted by importers, we asked Commerce to intervene quickly, not to expand the scope of the orders, but to clarify and confirm the scope language that we had worked so hard on throughout the investigation. So now just to respond to some of the answers to questions that the court posed earlier, your first question to both Fabiwood and IKEA addresses whether the court should examine the substance of Commerce's determination if it finds that the scope request was deficient. And yes, even if the court finds that the scope request were to find that the scope request was deficient, which it wasn't, this does not invalidate Commerce's scope determination. The regulations direct that Commerce will initiate a scope proceeding wherever it determines that the available information warrants an inquiry. So long as Commerce found that available information was present, it was able to undertake a scope inquiry. And this court has recognized that courts are most reluctant to find that an agency's failure to abide by any procedural requirements voids an agency action, as stated in the Mitsubishi case from 2017. So at most, Commerce's making of a scope determination based on a deficient request would be a procedural error that would not invalidate the agency's determination. Your question 2A to Fabiwood and question 5 to IKEA asked about the definition of the word particular and what is reasonably available. And Fabiwood responded that Petitioner Masterbrand had only a hypothetical situation in mind when we filed the original request and didn't improve on that with the amended request. That's incorrect. We had much more than a hypothetical situation in mind when we filed the original request and the amended request, and we provided information reasonably available to us demonstrating that this merchandise was, in fact, being imported. We met the regulatory requirement of providing a specific description of the merchandise at issue based on information reasonably available to us at the time. It's true that we had less information than importers, who often file scope requests where they can identify specific product model numbers or sizes or chemistries, so on, but Commerce properly found that we provided what was reasonably available to us, which is what the law and the regulations require. To hold U.S. producers to the same standard as importers would eliminate the words reasonably available from the regulations, and it would largely bar U.S. producers from requesting scope rulings. And I should add that to the extent there were any perceived ambiguities about the scope by importers, none of these importers ever took it upon themselves to file a scope request. In question 5 to IKEA, the court asked about the legislative history about what constitutes a sufficient petition. IKEA dismissed that as not relevant. We strongly disagree because it goes to the basic premise that what is reasonably available to a party depends on who that party is and what their circumstances are. A petitioner, whether for an AD/CVD petition or a scope petition, has less information about the imported products than the importers and the foreign manufacturers do. So that's a highly relevant consideration for Commerce to take into account and also for the courts to consider in assessing whether Commerce's actions were reasonable and in accordance with law. Your question 3 to Fabulwood and IKEA asked about the ArcelorMittal case and whether it was factually distinguishable, and clearly it was, as we stated in our brief at page 23. And Fabulwood also concedes the facts are distinguishable, although interestingly, IKEA does not. In the ArcelorMittal case, petitioners were attempting to expand the physical dimensions of the scope to include products with a nominal thickness of 4.75 millimeters or more, which were previously confirmed as being excluded from the order. We don't have anything like that in this case. So Fabulwood and IKEA's responses on this point are not persuasive. Your questions 4 and 5 to Fabulwood and questions 4 and 7 to IKEA relate to circumvention. Fabulwood claims that a scope inquiry should not be used when an anti-circumvention inquiry is more appropriate. But again, that's just not the question before the court or a question for Fabulwood to decide. The question of whether we could have filed for a circumvention inquiry is irrelevant. The issue for this court is whether Commerce's scope ruling was supported by substantial evidence and in accordance with law. And of course, we agree scope inquiries and circumvention inquiries address different scenarios. Scope inquiries deal with merchandise already covered by the scope language. Circumvention inquiries deal with merchandise that is not covered, that should be covered to address circumvention concerns. Here, we asked Commerce to confirm that the certain merchandise was covered by the plain language of the scope, which Commerce did. And the fact that we identified circumvention concerns in our request does not mean that we were actually seeking or should have sought circumvention inquiry. If respondents are failing to pay duties on merchandise that is covered by the plain language of the scope based on an improper interpretation of that scope language, scope inquiry is the proper or at least is a reasonable means to address that concern. And I should note that we also agree with the government that laminated woven sacks is a much different case. Your questions 6 and 7 to Fabulwood and question 8 to IKEA ask how the court should distinguish between defining the plain language of the orders and adding new language to the orders. Fabulwood's answer claims that this is not an issue of interpretation, but of expansion of the scope. And this is really respondent's entire argument, but it is incorrect. Commerce was interpreting and clarifying. It was not adding new language. Perhaps it's understandable why Fabulwood and respondents perceive this differently because they had a different interpretation of the language. And as the government mentioned, while Commerce found that the scope did not expressly state the manner in which RTA kitchen cabinets must be packaged and did not expressly define end user, Commerce found that other language in the scope informed these issues and made their meanings clear. So Commerce did not find that the scope was unambiguous with respect to these issues. I think that's a critical point. That's why we asked for the scope ruling, to make clear what we already thought was clear. But of course, to make it clear, it's sometimes necessary to provide discussion that uses additional or clarifying terms. In no way does that properly expand the scope. And whether respondents interpret the scope differently is not relevant, as long as Commerce's determination was supported by substantial evidence, which was, it must be affirmed, even where reasonable minds could have come to a different conclusion. The court's question 2B to IKEA asks if Commerce must always consider the K1 criteria without stopping at the plain meaning of the language. IKEA concedes that Commerce may make a scope decision on the plain language of the scope, but maintains that Commerce may not change its terms. The cases cited here by IKEA, Allegheny and Erickson, talk about Commerce abandoning a scope standard in favor of a different, more exacting one. Nothing like that occurred here. Commerce wasn't abandoning the scope order, it was clarifying it. The court's question 6 to IKEA asks whether this is an evasion allegation subject to Customs and Border Protection action or a circumvention allegation subject to Commerce action. And of course, we agree with the government, it was neither. IKEA doesn't answer at first, but then eventually says that in IKEA's view, an EAPA allegation best suits petitioner's claims. That's entirely incorrect, and it contradicts what the other plaintiffs have said in their briefs, and even what IKEA has said on pages 22 to 23 of its opening brief, where it discusses at length the remedy for allegations of circumvention. And this properly was a scope inquiry for the reasons we discussed earlier. And I would note, while Customs and Border Protection does have the authority to determine whether merchandise is evading AD/CVD orders, the authority to determine scope issues still lies with Commerce. So when faced with a question of whether merchandise alleged to be evading the order is in fact covered by the scope of the order, Customs and Border Protection requests that Commerce determine the scope issue. So that further confirms that a scope proceeding before Commerce was the proper avenue for our concerns. The court's question 9 to IKEA asks why Commerce, in IKEA's view, had to go to the K1 factors to confirm its conclusions. The court's correct here. If the scope language is unambiguous, Commerce can stop there, as it did in this case. IKEA, again, claims that Commerce limited the language and meaning of the RTA exclusion, but that is not accurate. In our view and in Commerce's view, all it did was clarify the meaning of the exclusion based on the scope language itself. Court's question 10 related to the rebuttal comments. I understand that's been withdrawn. Court's question 11 to IKEA relates to other cases and authorities. We also stand on our briefs on that question. I did also want to touch on the single package requirement that was mentioned. There are important reasons for that single package requirement. That's why we required it in the scope language, and why we needed it to be clarified in the scope ruling. And it's not for Fabiwood to say that we have the language or the protection that we need elsewhere. So with that, I will briefly address the additional questions that the court sent yesterday. Again,
thank you.
I think we align. Yes.
Right.
I think we align with the government. Your first question for all parties is whether there's a case that says that a scope inquiry is impermissible, where an anti-circumvention inquiry might also apply. We're also not aware of any cases that have addressed this precise issue. We don't think the cases cited by respondents address that question either. I would note in the UK carbon and graphite case from the court in 2013, the court addressed, and this was discussed by the government, the court addressed a case where domestic producers requested that Commerce conduct either a scope or circumvention inquiry, and Commerce ultimately determined that a circumvention proceeding was most appropriate. And the court recognized that Commerce can use both scope and circumvention inquiries to determine whether merchandise should be covered by the scope, and then stated, quote, the court may only review the underlying proceeding that Commerce chose to conduct. And therefore, any discussion relating, which was the anti-circumvention inquiry in this case, and therefore any discussion relating to the scope factors is extraneous and will be disregarded for this review. That's the end of the quote. That suggests that whether a circumvention inquiry could have been appropriate here is irrelevant. Commerce's determination should be based on the type of inquiry that it chose to conduct. Your second question for all parties was whether furniture or furniture parts with inputs of hardwood plywood are subject to the orders is a question best suited for Commerce in a scope request rather than court. We agree, yes, if interested parties are concerned that any particular furniture or furniture parts may improperly be considered within the scope, they can request a scope ruling and present those arguments. Scope language is always written in general terms, so it'll always give rise to questions of whether particular products are covered or not covered, and that's not changed by Commerce decision here. And then you asked one court a question to the government and to Petitioner Masterbrand about us seemingly taking different positions on Commerce's sua sponte authority to initiate scope inquiry. As an initial matter, as is clear from the government's response to the court's questions, our amended scope request was not deficient, so Commerce properly undertook a scope determination based on that request. Nevertheless, both we and the government appear to agree that Commerce may self-initiate a scope inquiry and that it may do so without all the information specified in the regulations, as stated in 225 B and C. So because Commerce can self-initiate a scope inquiry where it finds that the available information shows that an inquiry is warranted and needed, initiating an inquiry based on a deficient request is at most a harmless procedural error because Commerce also had the authority to initiate an inquiry and would have undertaken the same analysis. So with that, unless there are any other questions, I'll stop and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Breitel. That concludes our session. I'd like to thank counsel for your very illuminating arguments in a most interesting case. I will give counsel the opportunity to file a supplemental submission of not more than 3 single-spaced pages by Monday, 5 p.m. You're not compelled to make such a filing, but I want to give you the opportunity in light of the arguments this morning and file a supplemental submission, but that's up to you. For now, I wish you good health and safety. I think we're all looking forward to returning to the courthouse in New York. Look forward to seeing you all then. The recording of this morning's proceedings will be posted on the website probably within the hour. And with that, wish you all a good day. Thank you very, very much for your time. We are adjourned.
Thank you, Your
Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. We are adjourned. Mr. Gold?